This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you missed the program last week, I apologize. Bulldog football got in the way. That's going to happen again next week when the Dogs go to Cincinnati. But for today, I think we have a very entertaining show for you, a remarkable story from Jot Horn, a World War II veteran. I'll get to that story in a second. First, I want to remind you about the event coming up this coming week, September 23rd, 24th, and 25th at the VFW Post 8900 in Fresno. It is the Central Valley Veterans Stand Down 2009. For 3 days, veterans will have the help that they need in a lot of areas, dealing with California identification cards, Social Security cards, medical and mental health referrals, educational and employment opportunities. We're very aware that veterans coming home today sometimes need some help, and the help will be there for them at this year's Stand Down, September 23rd, 24th, and 25th at the VFW Post 8900. And if you want more information of that, if you are a veteran that is looking for help, or maybe you would like to contribute to this cause, here's the number that you can call for more information. It's 559-454-5436. That's 559-454-5436. You can find more information about that also at our website, kmjnow.com, where you'll also see a reminder about the Central Valley Blue Star Moms package drive. Don't forget to help out the veterans and our current servicemen and women all over the world today. With that said, let's get to today's guests. Each week, we shine a spotlight on the more than 16 million Americans who served our country during World War II. We want to honor their service and their sacrifice. We want to thank them for it. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget about them. And hopefully along the way, the rest of us can find a little inspiration in what our greatest generation did and that legacy that they are passing on to us. My guest today is Jot Horn, and he's got quite the story from his Navy days. After the Navy, did a little racing, too. We might have some time to talk about that. But let's start where I like to start with so many veterans. Jot, December 7th, 1941, you're just a teenager down in Southern California. What do you remember about that day and how you learned that all of a sudden America was now at war?
Well, Paul, I was shocked, of course, as most everybody. I was only 16, but I was just determined to get in that battle and do what I could. Of course, I was so young, I didn't know what I was doing. But soon after I turned 17, I did join the Navy with a friend of mine, but because my feet were a little flat and I had another minor problem, they didn't take me in until I turned 18, and they took me in then, flat feet and all.
Well, by that time they needed you because the war had been going on for a while. When was it that you finally did get in the Navy?
1943.
Mm-hmm. And was there a reason that you chose the Navy as opposed to the Army or the Air Corps or the Marine Corps?
Yes, I just desired the Navy over the Marine Corps. I don't think I could have made a very good Marine. They're pretty tough, and I don't call myself that tough.
Well, our listeners might have another opinion by the end of the show, but we'll see.
I don't know about that, but the Navy just seemed to be the answer for me, and I'm glad, Paul, I did choose the Navy.
Well, and it's remarkable that you're here to talk about it today with some of the close calls that you had. We're going to hear about some of those. Did you end up aboard the USS White Plains immediately? Was that your first ship?
Yes, we commissioned the ship in Astoria, Oregon, as I recall, early in 1943. And this was the CVE White Plains, CV meaning carrier vessel, and E meaning escort, which was considerably smaller than our main line carriers, and they referred to these small carriers as Kaiser Coffins, which didn't excite me all that much.
I can see why not. So they called them Kaiser Coffins.
That's right, yeah.
Did you guys get a little laugh out of that, or was that pretty unnerving?
Oh, that was just, that was just kind of a known things because he had built so many of these things, you know, using them in the Atlantic and the Pacific. And they're very small carrier, very thin plated, but they did a wonderful job in the war.
Well, and some pretty intense engagements that the White Plains would be involved in. What were your duties on the ship? Where did you spend most of your time?
Okay, I was an Airedale up on topside on the flight deck, and I operated the first four landing wires that the planes would pick up with their tail hook, and I would retrieve that wire and get ready for the next landing. I also was the catapult man for hooking up the TBMs and the heavily loaded fighters to shoot them off by catapult. So I had a two-way job, you might say, which I enjoyed very much.
Well, and that sounds to me like a job with a fair amount of responsibility, because when you're talking about taking off and landing on a carrier, for a lot of these pilots, that can become a life and death situation.
That's right. We didn't have a lot to do with their safety after they landed, but we were under a lot of danger because of bad landings or the wires. We had a number of wires break, and they're big one-inch stainless steel wires that, well, they could just chop your head off or mutilate you. And I've had those break, and I've ducked one that put a big furrow in the deck and hit the man nearby on a 40-millimeter gun and cut him all up, but he did survive.
So if that had hit, if you hadn't ducked, and that had hit your head,
that would have been the end of me, yes.
Well, I imagine those kind of situations take your breath away a little bit.
For a while. And then, of course, the bad landings. Some of our, usually a fighter, come in and would get twisted up a little bit, and they would come down, or the landing gear would collapse, and they would dig into the deck, and the props would sling all that stuff around. And I had one come pretty close, almost give me a haircut. And we had a number of bad landings, which just happens in all carrier action, you know.
Well, yeah, it's one thing landing a carrier in peacetime when nobody's shooting at you and you have a full tank of gas and a fully functioning airplane, but that wasn't always the case in some
right.
of these engagements.
Right.
Now, speaking of engagements, do you remember the first taste of combat and naval battle that you got aboard the White Plains and how that changed things for you? Because I imagine it wasn't the same the day after you got that first taste of war.
No. We picked up our squadron in San Diego, went to sea, and began to do sub-patrol, combat air patrol. And they sent us to, we had already gone to Tarawa and Macon and delivered planes there as a transport for planes that were being lost in the Pacific.
Right.
We did that twice and come back to San Diego. We picked up VC-1, our squadron, and went to sea ready to do battle. They sent us to Saipan and Tinian, and Guam was in that group of islands too. And we had intense battle there with many, many aircraft coming in trying to get us. And our first plane I saw go down was a twin-engine Betty, and we shot it down, and it went into the sea with a big splash. And you feel funny, even though there are enemies, that five men lost their lives, you know.
Sure.
And then we shot down a number of Zeros and Zeeks. And we were in a group of six carriers and seven destroyers. And we were called Taffy 3, and we were at Saipan Tinian. Tinian, you know, was the island that the B-29 took off to bomb Hiroshima.
The Enola Gay, absolutely.
Right. And we were there almost 100 days to finish that battle. And then we went to Peleliu, and we were there just maybe a month. That was a fairly short battle. And we got through that in pretty good shape without much loss in planes or any ships lost in that battle. And then we got ready for the big one, and that was at Leyte in the Philippines.
Well, that was the one that is just remarkable, and that will, I think, blow a lot of people away when they hear the whole story about that. I do want to ask you, Jot, while we're talking about this, and you described these engagements, you told us before what your duties were as far as the line to catch the tailhooks of the planes coming back in. Now, when fire is exchanged both ways, when you have incoming aircraft from the enemy, your planes are taking off, the guns are being shot both ways. Were you ever in a situation where you came off that line and were manning anti-aircraft guns?
Only in practice.
Mm-hmm.
I had fired the 20 millimeter only once in practice, and the 40 millimeter only once in practice, and we were shooting at balloons being towed by our own planes, you know.
So, but you were ready in case it ever required.
Yes. I don't know if we'd have ever hit anything, although I did shoot the balloon down, believe it or not.
But, well, there you go. Put a little notch in your belt for that one.
Well, just a lucky hit is all. But, no, we were not, we were prepared, but we did not have the occasion to be used on the guns. We were very busy doing what we did with the aircraft.
That makes sense to me. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right here. When we come back, we'll get more into this story of the Battle of the Leyte Gulf. You've heard it discussed before on this program with other veterans that were there, but I think you'll be very intrigued by the personal experiences of Jot Horn. We'll get to what his mother was doing during this time that he is very thankful for, and we'll get all of the close calls that he experienced. Jot Horn is our guest today. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Remember, on that website, you can find past editions of the program. And also remember, if you ever have a veteran of the World War II era that you think I ought to catch up with, you can email me, paul@kmjnow.com. When we left off with today's guest, Jot Horn, he had discussed his early days in the Navy, some of the engagements that his ship, the USS White Plains, an escort-class carrier, was involved in. And then he got to a few references of what happened in October of 1944 in the Leyte Gulf off the Philippines. And the White Plains was one of several ships that was really outnumbered by the Japanese forces in that area. Enough of me telling you about it. Let's get back to the guy who was there, Jot Horn, who is joining us today. Now, you were topside on your ship, the White Plains.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first sense that you got that the battle was beginning there at the Leyte Gulf?
Okay. We had just gone through a terrible storm, a typhoon that began to rip us up, and we had the welders going on trying to hold us together, keep us from breaking in two, and that lasted 3 days. And some of our ships, because of the 100 mile an hour plus winds, lost some of their ships. Well, we got through that, and we got down near Leyte. We were heading down Surigao Straits one night when our submarine sent us a message, and it said the whole main arm of the Japanese fleet was headed down Surigao Straits, but they would not, if they kept their course, they would not intercept us. So we says, well, okay. But at 5 in the morning, they had changed course, and they did intercept us. And boy, I'm telling you, we were in for it. for this was their main fleet. It had four battle wagons, enormous wagons, eight cruisers, 13 destroyers. And here they come. And boy, this was a hornet's nest. And we were the first ship to get fired upon. And the gigantic salvos landed on the port and starboard side, lifted the stern up out of the water, knocked us down on our knees. And we thought, sure, we were in for it. We were going to be sunk right there.
So you had survived the typhoon, which yeah. I'm sure those 3 days, you spent a lot of those 3 days probably praying.
You bet.
You certainly didn't have any planes to launch in a typhoon. But this sounds like it was worse than the typhoon.
Well, it was. We thought, well, we'd just gone through a typhoon, a little hard to handle after that, and then to be hit by this gigantic fleet, which we weren't designed to go against anything like that because they had over 100 times more firepower than we did and had almost twice the speed. So we were undergunned and under speed, you might say, and in terrible condition to be up against that kind of situation. And so we, our Admiral Sprague, he says, carriers, run for it. And destroyers, he sent them back on a suicide mission to try to slow them down and try to get a few torpedo hits if they could do anything to save the carriers. Well, they did that, and those brave destroyer guys were something because they went right back into the midst of that hornet's nest and began to fire away their 5-inch guns. They were so close, they could hit them with a 5-inch and shoot their torpedoes. And so it was just a battle royal going on. And if this had been the U.S. Navy against this kind of a fleet, we would have sunk them in 5-10 minutes.
That's what should have happened to you.
That's what should have happened, just almost immediately. But something was going on, and we didn't know what it was. But all of a sudden, after that battle had gone on for a while, there was a great rain squall, a big squall of water, like a tremendous rainstorm, come down upon our fleet. And the Japanese didn't have sophisticated radar as we did, and they couldn't see us. So they stopped firing, but they continued to try to follow us. And this rain squall went on for maybe 20 minutes, half hour. And we just were trying to run for our lives. And it was quite a battle going on with our nerves, I'll tell you that, because we didn't know what was going to happen when that rain squall lifted. And here these big ships were still on our tail. And when we got hit with that salvo shells, it knocked out our power, and the gunner gave me a screwdriver and said, "Say, would you check here and see when we get power?" And I did. When the screwdriver melted in my hand, I knew we had power for the guns, you know.
Good thing your hand didn't melt with it.
Right. My station was right back there where the 40-millimeter guns were. And so these big 14, 16, 18-inch salvos, they were just straddling us, and we would look over and see the orange blotches, and, you know, you could just count the seconds. 5, 6, boom. We knew if they went off, if they went overhead, they just made a terrible screaming noise. We knew we were all right because they had gone beyond, they'd explode beyond us. But when those big orange blotches come up, we thought, well, maybe this one's the one we bought, you know, and they would land short of us. And we just couldn't figure it out why they weren't hitting us. So this went on with them going crazy in the water all over the ocean. We didn't understand why they just didn't close in and kill us immediately. They did come in and with a very heavy fire, they sank the Gambier Bay, one of our carriers, with 14 and 16-inch gunfire. And the three of our destroyers were also sunk, and some of them had 40 hits and almost just took a dive with the loss of about 300 men on some. It was a terrible loss of life with the destroyers. And other carriers were being hit, some of them with shell fire, armor-piercing shells, and they went right through our thin skin without blowing up. So it was there was quite a battle going on here. And the other four destroyers were being torn up pretty bad with the shell fire. But we couldn't understand why they didn't close in and get us all, because there was five other carriers left that were setting ducks. We could only go 17 knots. They could go 33. And so we were just baffled by it all. And all of a sudden, they turned off and begin to turn back for Japan.
Now, before they did that, though, and you mentioned that the gunfire, the artillery, was missing you, but I understand the kamikazes didn't all miss you.
Yes, they showed up, Paul, about an hour or two later.
Okay, so you have the chronology right. I didn't mean to get you out of chronological order there. So they turned around.
They turned around and took off for Japan, and we steamed on ahead. One of our engines was hit. The mounts were broken, and we thought at any time it would fall in the bilges. But it did not break until after the kamikaze. Now, the kamikaze come in. There was eight of them come in on us. We shot the different carriers, shot three of them down, and the other five selected a carrier. And the one that selected us came down, he's doing better than 400 miles an hour. You could almost see the guy's face in the cockpit. We thought he was going to hit the ship, but the wheel man spun the wheel, and it caused the ship to slip out from under him. He and his bomb went off in the water, but all of that plane and pilot and everything come up on the flight deck, a good part of it, and we just had a mess there, and I had to help clean that up so we could land some planes later. But just about then, I looked over, and our sister ship, the St. Lowell, one of the kamikazes had come down on it, and it landed smack in the elevator shaft, and I began to see fire coming out the sides. The ammunition was blowing up, and the ship was in just blowing to pieces. And it began to fall back, and within 15 minutes, she began to sink. And, a high loss of life there, too. And that was our sister ship, the St. Lowell.
And so that gave you a pretty clear picture right there. Already, you've had plenty of close calls and seen how close you had come to going down. But that right there, I mean, your sister ship gets hit by a kamikaze and is sunk in 15 minutes. kind of tells you that easily the same thing could happen to you at any point.
Oh, we thought we were the first one to go because we took the first two salvos, you know, and knocked us down on our knees thinking, oh, boy, we're done. But somehow we were spared, and so we began to head back for Pearl Harbor, and they announced that because of our injuries and to the ship and the men, that we were going to Pearl Harbor and then San Diego, and they said that we were going to get our each section would get 30-day leave. Well, I was on the first section, so when we landed in Pearl Harbor, I thought, I'm going to write my mom a letter and tell her I'm coming home. And it took us 30 days to get there because we only had one engine, could only go about 8 or 9 knots. And I thought, no, I'll surprise her. I'll just show up there.
And I'm going to cut you off right there because
okay.
We need to catch another break. But you did have quite the surprise for your mother, and she had quite the surprise for you,
sure
as
did.
It turns out. So we're going to get that story when we come back. Jot Horn, Navy veteran of World War II, our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm sure you're enjoying the stories today from Jot Horn. He's 84 years old. He's lived in Oakhurst for the last quarter century, but back in October of 1945, he was one of many American sailors enduring a marathon battle at the Leyte Gulf. It's also known as the Battle Off Samar. You may have heard it referred to that way. His ship, the USS White Plains, would earn a Presidential Unit Citation for her part in that Battle Off Samar. That was one of five battle stars that the White Plains earned during World War II. And you heard Jot talk about that, how intense that battle was, how long that battle was. Did you realize how long it really was as it was in progress, or did it just seem to go by quickly?
No, it was long, Paul. It seemed like instead of 2 hours and 40 minutes, like 20 hours and 40 minutes, you know? In fact, we were so beat by that intensity that our legs were shaking, and we were so weak, we from lack of food. We didn't have food or drink for several hours, and or for some time, and we couldn't hardly stand up because we were so weak. We had to lay down to eat a sandwich that the mess men had brought up for us, you know, and our legs were rubbery and shaking, and we had to lay down to eat a sandwich.
Wow.
And so it was the longest naval battle in history, and our losses were pretty high. We had 792 men killed and 768 men wounded, plus 40 of our very courageous pilots and airmen were killed in this combined battle.
And when we talked about it, I don't want to gloss over this. There was a point early in the morning, and this was happening fairly early, but a little before 9:30 in the morning, where the Japanese fleet under Vice Admiral Kurita actually turned around and left. And to you and your fellow sailors at the time, this was inexplicable because they had a clear advantage, and you were just basically waiting to be finished off, for lack of a better term.
Paul, we were absolutely shocked and just wondered. We wondered all that day and later, why did they give up on us when they had us dead, you know? And as I mentioned before, had it been reversed, we wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes. Not 10 minutes.
And meanwhile, he also told us about the intervention of the weather, the rain squall that held them off for a while, held them at bay. And then before we left off, you mentioned as you headed back for Pearl Harbor, limping along at 8 knots, which is a snail's pace, you contemplated writing your mother a letter to let her know the good news that you were coming home. And for some reason, you decided against it. You decided you would go surprise her.
That's right, Paul. I thought, well, I'm just going to surprise my mother. So that next 10 days went by awful slow. from Pearl Harbor to San Diego. And as I said, I got the first 30-day leave. I hitched a ride home, and I knocked on the door, and my mother met me, and oh, I was so happy to see my mother. I tell you, I was overjoyed because I knew she had been praying for me, you know. Mm-hmm. And the first thing she said after we hugged and bawled and squalled for a while, "Jump, where were you on October 24th? I says, "Oh, no, no, Mother, it was October 25th. Oh, she says, "No, sir, it was the 24th. Well, you know, we're dealing with a time zone change, you know.
It was a day later in the Philippines than in, Maywood, California.
That's right. And we got that out of the way, and she says, "John, the Lord spoke to me and said you were in grave danger and to pray." And she said, "I begin to pace and walk and travail and pray." And she said, "I prayed for about 2 hours and 40 minutes. And then the Lord said, said, your son is safe in my hands," and gave her a psalm. I believe, Paul, if I'm not mistaken, it was the 91st psalm. And, oh, I tell you, I just rejoiced with her because I knew the Lord had intervened and had saved not only my life, but the life of about 10,000 other men, you know. Now, I know this, Paul, that other men's, young men's mothers and fathers were praying, too. I know that. But I know my mother prayed for me, and that's how I got through the war without one scratch.
Was that?
Except in boot camp, I skinned my arm real bad on a bolt on a bunk.
If that's the worst that happened to you, you're in pretty good shape.
Except I was awful scared several times, and as were the rest of the guys, you know.
Well, and I know that you told me before that you're convinced there could have been six or seven, even more times that you were very close to being killed during your time in the service.
Exactly. In Saipan, there was a torpedo bomber coming in, Paul, and I says, "I'm a dead man." And I could look in this Japanese fellow's eyes, and we were firing everything we had at him, and they splashes in front of him and in back of him, and he would hit exactly where I was, right under me. I would have been blown in a thousand pieces. But the gunfire nailed him just before he released that torpedo, and I was spared because I would have been a dead man.
Well, when your mother told you this, that she was praying for you for 2 hours and 40 minutes, were you wondering, maybe she read a news report about this battle? Were you at all skeptical, or did you immediately know, no, this is what was happening, this is why I was spared, and this is why the Japanese turned around, this is why I'm here today?
No, I believe having been raised in the church, I believed in miracles. And I, Paul, I believed that this was God's intervention. And we began to read stories that were written on that, and I had read several, and every one of them mentioned that this must have been a providence intervention from the Lord to keep us from being killed because of the overwhelming odds that were against us. And so that was, I believed that the Lord had saved each one of us.
Well, there have been several books about that battle, and all describing it as one of the greatest underdog moments in wartime history, that so many Americans were able to survive and make it on for the rest of the war. Now, your ship, as you mentioned, came back, and it was a while before you headed back out to sea with the USS White Plains. Were you back on the ship?
No.
You were done.
They sent me on to a short time to Oak Knoll Hospital. I had a problem with seasickness, believe it or not, Paul, of all things. I still have motion sickness when I get on a little boat or swing in a swing, or I've had that all my life. So I suffered with that and had complained at one time to the doctor. So they sent me to Oak Knoll, and I stayed there just a few weeks and then went on to Naval Landing Force Depot, where I was on guard duty there. And here, several things happened. I was able to, I carried a shotgun and a pistol guarding those naval landing craft as if anybody would try to steal one of those, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I, they called us out to the pistol range one day with a 45, and I began to fire that, and I'll be doggone if I didn't get the cap record with 50 out of 50. I think it was an 8-inch bull at 25 yards, 75 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave me a better job then, and they get the worst job to begin with, way out in a landing where they stored these boats. And so I was the captain's messenger. And then one day I was called to captain's mast, and I thought, what have I done? I don't recall going ashore and getting into trouble, although they threw me in the brig once when I was in a bar with some fellows, and they threw us all in there. and just let us go after a few hours. But I thought, I don't know what this is all about, but I had to go and dress blues and went in, and the captain of the Naval Landing Force Depot says, Jot Horm, step forward, and I did. And he says, according to section so and so forth and blah, 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 President of the United States, he is through the battle at Lady Gull, you have obtained the presidential unit citation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you understand, Paul, that's a unit. Everybody gets
that's
that
right. Yep.
In the battle. And so I was real happy with that and wore that on my blues, too, of course. And we also got the Admiral's Commendation citation, which was a green one we had, too. So I had on my uniform six bars because I had been in five naval battles and the Good Conduct Medal and the Asiatic Pacific Medal, the Presidential Unit Citation, the Admiral's Accommodation Medal. I don't know what the sixth one was, but anyway, I could wear six of those on my uniform. So I was proud of those and wore those when I went ashore. And that was several months old. After I've got the Presidential Unit Citation,
mm-hmm.
they put me on the front gate, and that was the best job in the Navy. And from there, they sent me to Livermore to be discharged, and I went on home, and immediately I began to build race cars for the Dry Lakes and for Bonneville National Speed Trials.
Now, I want to ask you more about that, but I think we're up at that time where we need to take our last little pause here to get some advertising in.
All right.
And we'll talk more about that and what you've been doing since those days when we come back. Jot Horn, Navy veteran of World War II, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
As usual, the time goes by way too quickly here on Hometown Heroes. Been such a delight visiting with Jot Horn, hearing some of his experiences in the Navy during World War II, the incredible twist that his story took when he got back home and learned his mother had been praying for him for the entire 2 hours and 40 minutes, coinciding with that battle off Samar, one of the most incredible naval battles in World War II. But he's had some interesting experiences in the years since then. You know, we hear so much today about drag racing. Gary Selzy here in the Valley has had such a great career. But in the early days of those fast cars on the salt flats of Utah, Jott was one of the pioneers. In 1949, he set a speed record in a 27 Model T Roadster with a Duesenberg engine in it, if you can believe that. And some of you car guys would really love to hear a whole nother hour on just that, but we'll try to squeeze some of it in about 5 minutes or so. Jott, tell me, first of all, how you got involved in racing and trying to go fast. Was it all that experience catapulting planes off of a carrier that got you fired up?
No, I tell you, Paul, I used to, when I was a kid, about 10 or 12, used to walk by Bell Auto Parts, and Bell Auto Parts was a racing store, and they always had midgets or big cars parked in the front of guys going in there to buy things. Clark Gable, he was in there at times to buy things for his Krager Model A, and so I was just intrigued by those race cars, and I just loved race cars. So when I got out of the Navy, I built this, I got a T-body, a Roadster T-body, and found a Duesenberg, a rich man in Beverly Hills that owned Coca-Cola there, had one for sale, just the engine. He had two of them in a boat, and I bought the engine for $450 and stuck it in this T-body with a belly pan. And I run it at El Mirage, and I went almost 143 with it there, and that was 13 miles an hour faster than the record.
So with all the close calls you had in the Navy, you were just ready to put yourself in harm's way again, huh? You sound like a glutton for punishment.
Yeah, but I loved racing, and this was time trials, you know. And so I 1949 come along, and I took the car to Bonneville and set a record there, not as fast because it's a little higher altitude,
right,
of 127, I think. You run two ways, one way, and then you break the record, and then you come back, and if it's fast enough, you set the record.
Right, you
so
back it up.
That was a record set, the first Bonneville Nationals, 49. Of 127. Paul, are probably running 250 in that class now.
Well, times are different, but they don't have a lot of Duesenberg straight eights around
no,
anymore.
No, that's right. That's true. That was a wonderful, wonderful engine that was, the way it was built was just outstanding.
Now, I know we're getting short on time in the show, but you felt strongly that your life had been spared during your naval service by divine intervention, and I understand you had maybe an even closer call, racing?
Yes, not racing, Paul, but I went to a race in Palm Springs where Jimmy Dean and Phil Hill and other notables were racing. I went with a friend. I got deathly sick, and I says, Max, I'm going to go out here in the desert and just get away from this for a little bit. Well, I walked out there. I began to get sicker and sicker and sicker. And I just found a hole in the desert all alone, and I just fell into that hole. And I laid there, and I knew I was dead. I knew my life was over, and I had no chance of ever getting out of that hole again. I laid there for 10, 15 minutes. My strength began to come back, and with all the strength that I had, I got up out of that hole and found my friend again. We finished the race, went on back home 130 miles to Maywood, and when I got out of the car, my mother met me at the walkway, and she said, Jott, what happened to you today at noon? I said, oh, Mom, I almost died. And she says, I was in church, and church was just over, and the Lord said that you were dying. And I went to the altar, and I began to pray, and I prayed, And I prayed for about 15 or 20 minutes, and the Lord said that I was safe in His hands, and that all was well. And so she came home, and she knew I was coming home.
Wow.
And I was just shocked by that.
Unbelievable.
And so, Paul, it wasn't too many years later that I says, hey, I'm going to commit my life to the Lord. And so in 33, I asked Jesus to come into my heart and reside there, forgive me of all my sins, and be my Savior. And He did, Paul. And I tell you, my life has been rich and blessed ever since. So I can sure highly recommend the Lord to anybody who is looking to better their life and make heaven their home.
Well, and we can all hear that sincerity in your voice. And
yes.
And I'm definitely not arguing with you there. But thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time on the program, but thank you for serving our country, for sharing those stories with us, and for being so real, so candid, so sincere today. Jot Horn has been our guest today. You've been listening to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.